Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good. Welcome.
Dude, thanks for having me, man.
You've been traveling for how long?
I haven't done the math, but I think I crested the 30-hour threshold, like a two-nighter thing, and then heading west. Heading west is easier than heading east,
yes.
But you're still just like in the middle of one of the flights, I'm just like shaking. I was like, man, I haven't had enough water, and then I have too much water, and then I just have to run to the bathroom to throw it up. It was like one of those, it ain't one of those things. It was not my worst travel experience, but just happy to be home.
So you were in Budapest for what, 2 weeks?
Like 13 days for the World Championships.
And when he says World Championships, track and field.
Track and field, yep.
And guys, Trey Hardy, if you didn't know, is a retired Olympian himself, silver medal. Mm-hmm. And you're going for NBC to commentate on?
On all the field events.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so basically I didn't make the 2016 team, got hurt in the middle, and one of the producers sent me a message. I landed in Austin, and he's like, hey, you want to come back out to the track tomorrow? We'd love to, like, put you in the mix and see what you got. And I never expressed any interest in doing that. I was like, hey, sorry, I'm in Austin, maybe next time. And he's like, no, we'll fly back out. We want to basically test you out and see if you can do it. Didn't want to do it. And my wife's like, you're going back. Like, I'm not going to – basically, I'm not going to sit around with you all summer here. Like, go back and check it out.
Sounds like a wife comment.
Yeah. So the next day, like 3 o'clock, I was in Eugene, Oregon on the track with a mic in my hand, kind of too dumb to be nervous. And then 2 days later, same producers yelling at me as I'm walking to the airport to my Uber. Hey, do you want to go to Rio? And then at that point, I'm like, yep, let's do it. And so just kind of been doing it ever since. And it wasn't something I saw on TV and wanted to do, and it wasn't like a passion or anything like that, but it really is such a cool experience for me to be able to do, and now it feels like I'm proud that I get to be like the steward of the field events to bring that to people who, number one, love the sport, but really, honestly, people who don't love the sport. Like people who just casual fan, maybe the TV's on, and they're like, well, what's going on here? You know?
I mean, do you feel like you also get to defend the athletes when people are so quick to criticize on a poor performance? And
oh yeah, 10 out of 10. Like, and especially what's going on now with Noah Lyles and the NBA and all this stuff. Like, it just feels like I'm a part of the media, but also a former athlete. Like, been there, done that. But
have you weighed in?
I did. Yeah, I just did. I've weighed in a couple of times. I've kind of stayed on the sidelines, but then now I've kind of weighed in on a couple of other NBA content people who are like chiming in.
And I'm sorry, could you give the context of what now?
Yeah, so the fastest man on the planet, the man that just won the 100-meter dash and the 200-meter dash at the World Championships, American Noah Lyles.
For our country.
For the United States of America. So, yeah, that's the hardest part about broadcasting. I can't say we or us. It is so hard. And we have like a tip jar, basically. You have to put a dollar in every time you say it. And there's some weeks where there's like 40, 50 bucks in there. It's wild. But so he just, in a post, race interview, receiving his, I think he was getting his 4x1 medal. So he had 3 golds, anchored the 4x1, won the 100, won the 200. The only man that's faster than him in the history of the world in the 200 is Usain Bolt. He's number 2 all time. So he just says, it feels great to be a world champion and like a real world champion, it doesn't make sense. The National Basketball Association, they give their trophy and they call it the World Championships. Or like, I'm king of the world, like after the Super Bowl or something like that. It's a national league, and it doesn't, like, I'm a world champion. Everybody runs. Every country was here. They had a chance, and I beat them all. And then Kevin Durant clapped back real quick on Instagram and basically, like, put up a flare, and then a bunch of NBA superstars tagged on and were like, man, sit down. Like, and then I think it was Gordon. His name Aaron Gordon? Like, 6'10" dude. Like, can jump out of the gym. He's explosive, and he's mm-hmm. And I'll be the first to say some of the best athletes in the world play in the NBA. That is the most athletic and athletically demanding, like, problem solving sport. Quick decisions. You got to be an athlete. I always thought Russell Westbrook would have been a great decathlete. Like, mm-hmm. made sense. But yeah, he said he would beat him in a 200, and then I'm just sitting on like the sidelines, just like okay. I mean, this is good. It's good for the sport. Get some new eyeballs on it. Get some. Chirping, it's always nice, it's always good, but at this point it's like those people who think they can win a point off of Djokovic. Like, yeah, I could get in there. I played tennis in high school, I could win a point. No, you couldn't. But anyway, my job is like to not be negative and catty and like call people out and compare. My only job, like from the very beginning, like, hey, Trey, you're here to be positive. You're here to replace, you know, some people on the team that were kind of critical and negative and weren't going to change. And so we just want you to be positive and happy. And I'm like, that's easy because I love this stuff. It's incredibly impressive every time to see it. And now it just feels like this great honor that I get to kind of, like, I don't care if I get on camera. I don't care how much time I spend on the broadcast. But the time I do get, I really just take advantage of it and try to be authentic, which is just, like, I'm excited to see stuff.
Is it hard to... And I'm speaking from what I used to do to now, I almost feel, it feels like imposter syndrome. Do you still, like, hey, that used to be me?
I don't let myself cross the boundary back into, like, former athlete Trey, because mm-hmm. then you get into, like, kind of, like, having a beer at the bar and talking about old PRs and, like, oh, I remember this time, and this was what I was thinking. And I try to stay away from that as much as I can, and I think about the best, you know, what I try to do is explain things in a way that would get – my drunk aunt excited to me on the next to me on the couch. Like, that was the best analogy I ever got right when I was starting out. It was like, hey, don't get too caught in the weeds, but, like, how would you make your aunt, if your aunt's sitting next to you, she's had a few drinks, how would you get her excited about the discus or the pole vault or something like that and help her understand what just happened here? And so that's kind of where I always come from it. And then I'll write, like, in big Sharpie, be happy or joyful or something positive, just to, like, always revert back to that.
Now, being a decathlete, I'm assuming that makes you more well-rounded to commentate because you've done so many of the events, you've got an opinion on them all.
All of them except hammer and triple jump, but I did train with hammer and triple jumpers. So when I'm throwing discus out there, I'm next to a hammer thrower and picking it up, and I've thrown hammer a few times, not very far, and then triple jumped a couple times. But yeah, that pretty much is it. I think from the producer's standpoint at NBC, I had the appropriate background. It's mm-hmm. just, is this going to be a, you know, a deer in headlights situation, or is this going to be a guy we can just throw to, he can carry it, and he can throw it back kind of thing. But, yeah, being a decathlete, you know, by nature, you're not, like, the best in the world at any one thing. You're just not bad at anything, you know, and you just pick stuff up quickly. And because you're not just great at anything, you kind of have to be very technical. You really got to understand it, because you're not just going out there and walking people down and, like, jumping far. You got to earn it, you know?
It's funny you say not a, you know, the best athletes in track and field, though, are the ones that can do a lot of things. While we're talking about the fastest man in the world, he's very good at that one thing where you're almost like the general manager. You've got a wide breadth of experience.
Yeah, so in 1912, I think King Ferdinand of Sweden was handing out the medals mm-hmm. at the Olympics, and Jim Thorpe won the all-around, yes. and he won the long jump and the high jump and all these other things, and he handed out his last medal to Jim Thorpe, and he says, you, sir, are the greatest athlete in the world. Mm-hmm. Boom. Put a pin in it, and then for the rest of time, that's been the moniker of, like, the Olympic or world champion in the decathlon. They are the greatest athletes in the world. And just for what it encompasses, I think that's kind of an attractor for some guys too. Like, yeah, I'm a good athlete, I want to do this. And it ain't easy. Like, it's not this, like, yeah, I'm fast, it's just going to take me a couple of years to get real fast. It's a grind. Like it is, it's hard. There's metaphors galore for it, but golf is a real, really good analogy. No one just picks up a golf club first time and shoots, you know, under par. And even if you do shoot under par, there's always that one or two strokes where you're like, oh man, that three putt, or man, I missed the green here, or I had to, you know, go up and down. It could have been a lot better. And it kind of keeps you addicted, you know, and you got to have a bunch of shots in your bag, a bunch of clubs. Yeah. You got to play in different wet. You're playing against the weather. You're kind of playing against other people, but not really, you know, like you're really playing against par. And that's the decathlon too. So it's a bunch of cut from the same cloth kind of bros.
For the listeners, break down all the events that go into a decathlon.
Yeah, so it's not kayaking or biking or yeah, it's not that. That's usually the first question.
Shooting.
Yeah, yeah, it's usually the first question. Oh, what kind of bike do you ride? And I was like, I don't own a bike, bruh. So it's 10 events over 2 days, and it breaks down the same way every time. There's 5 events first day, 5 events second day.
Does that ever change, the order of them?
It never changes in the order, but sometimes there are weather happens, things happen, and then the scores get a little, they get put in a different category, but there are 3-day decathlons. It just has to be 48 hours from the start to the finish. Mm-hmm. Weather is the only excuse for it to kind of roll over to 3 days, but it's the 100, the long jump, the shot put, the high jump, and the 400. That's day one. And then the next day is the 110 hurdles, discus, pole vault, javelin, and 1500. And so it's just 9 speed, power, explosive events, and then one just ball buster.
Favorite event?
Pole vault, 100%. So that was all I did in high school. That was like first love. That thing's cool. It's not like the others. I want to learn how to do that. And I got okay at it. I was from Alabama, so like I was good for Alabama, but not worthy of a scholarship anywhere, you know? And got to college, got a book scholarship to Mississippi State, and got to college. And then they were like, hey, you're fast. You already know how to pole vault. Hurdles look okay. You're going to train for the decathlon. And I'm like, oh, I'd never really trained before. You know, I just picked up a pole and pole vaulted every day and just hated it for like 5 or 6 months, like until I did my very first one. And then it was like, oh, this is it. I like this.
You can dominate.
Not even that. I think I finished like 8th place at the Texas Relays, my very first one, but it was still, I got to compete over 10 things, and I got this like point total, and I saw guys that were NCAA champions and had won conference titles, and I was like, I'm better than those guys. I think I can do this, you know? And it was like, let's just keep these up. Let's see how many, like, how quick can I get good? You know, how many points can I score next time? It's like a round of golf. Like I wanted to get back out there and do it again.
Event you hated the most?
I think there's two hates. There's like, oh, hate. Like this is going to suck. And that's 1500.
I knew you were going to say it.
I don't think anybody's favorite is that, but no. it's at the end of a real grueling process, no matter how perfect it's going, your tank's empty. And you're always running for something or running from somebody, like someone's chasing you or you're chasing something. And it really is, doesn't matter what's going on, it hurts the same. Like a 5 flat 1500 or a 430, it hurts just the same. So it really is like, all right, you're just going to have to do it now. Like there isn't any like best scenarios where it's easier, you know? But then the worst, like the one I really didn't like the most, that was the most frustrating, was the high jump, where like the biomechanics and my explosiveness and my skill and everything else just didn't really translate. Like I have a 42.5-inch vertical leap off 2 feet, standing there, jumping up, could run and touch the top of the backboard. And I could barely high jump like 6'8", 6'9" consistently, like barely. Like I could jump 6'7" consistently, which is like 2 meters, but just could not like break through. It was just this weird, frustrating, still I'm getting frustrated even talking about it to you right now. And it just was the one event that I just never felt like I unlocked. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because I'm sure there's so many different ways to train for it. How did you train specifically for the decathlon? I mean, every single day, I mean, would you hit the five events and just rotate, or would you focus on one thing per day sometimes?
I was really lucky that my first coach, he had a great coach in college. He was a college decathlete at LSU. And he was coached by Dan Pfaff, who's just a legend in sports science, physiology, and coaching in general, but he was a really good decathlon coach. And we basically played the long game. You know, I was learning all the events except pole vault. And it wasn't like, okay, crash course in this, crash course in this. It was, hey, let's train commonalities. Let's train, here's how we're going to do it. Every week is going to look the same. And we're playing the game where Trey's going to be great at 24, 25, 26, not 19, 20. Mm-hmm. And have these like peaks and valleys and ups and downs. And every event got the same amount of attention for going on like 10 years before we kind of switched up how we trained as I got older and got that, you know, kind of old man strength and knew where the low hanging fruit was.
That's just overwhelming. It would feel like your hair's on fire. The amount of things you've got to, I mean, do you feel like you became a, I mean, you're competing at the top level. Did you consider yourself an expert in all the events?
By the end, yes. Yes. I could have stepped in and replaced anybody's coach. It was like, you're over in Europe and someone's like, my coach isn't here. Will you catch this or watch this? I'm like, yeah, totally. Like I could have stepped in for anything except for like a middle distance runner. I wasn't going to program workouts for them or do anything like that. But it ended up being the case where, not by design, but over time, I did it for so long, you develop first, you know, a little bit of physical ability, then you learn some competency, and then you learn the underpinnings of why you've been doing the things that you've been doing, and then you learn the, like, kind of like the theory behind that human performance and how to peak and periodize and how to create this kind of strength and speed and power and velocity and where all those fall on the spectrum, and then how to time everything up physiologically where aerobic power and anaerobic power can be timed up, max velocity, absolute strength, and all that stuff. And that's how we kind of set up our training so that all those things would intersect on the days of a decathlon.
So you start out at Mississippi State, they drop the program, go to UT, yep. But you finish on the outdoor championships, you know, NCAA champion in 2005. Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, you set the record for the NCAA.
Yeah. And it was awesome at the time, but now I think I'm like fifth on the list. Like the guys that have been coming through lately are just insane. But yeah. It was an instant success. Like, really, it was the translation was really, really good. I got along with my teammates. My coach mm-hmm. was awesome. And it just was the right decision for me, right environment. And it was kind of, I was big fish, little pond, and then moved into the biggest pond. And then you're running around. There's, you know, TJ Ford. There's Vince Young. There's Kevin Durant. There's, like, Houston Street, Cat Osterman, Sonya Richard Ross. You're just like, whoa, this is awesome. Like, and you're just surrounded by this success and excellence, and then the way that everybody went about their day and their business and the athletic department in general was just this, like, rising tide that it just gave me a little bit more belief, you know, like being in that environment.
And I'm sure there's an element of, as you said earlier, either compete or lose your scholarship. You're gone.
I mean, a little bit, but it I always felt like it was a job. Like the day, I mean, even my little book scholarship, I felt like it at Mississippi State, it felt like it was a job. Like, and I had always worked from the age of 14 till like right now, you know, always held down some kind of I'm going to do this for create value somewhere and do this work. And so for me, it was really just fulfilling that commitment and earning my spot and earning the money that I was getting. And I knew I never felt pressured. I just knew if I always showed up every day and did that work, it tracks a beautiful sport like that. If you actually do show up and do the work, you do get better. That's how our bodies work. The stress, there's no like, you know, qualitative version where you get style points and you're just, oh, that judge just didn't like me. No, no, no. We're going to know what you did. We're going to know how you trained because there's a number there, centimeters, seconds, whatever. We're going to know. And so I always love that about it. There was no judge or referee that could take anything away, and I was ultimately responsible for my own success. You know, like if I didn't show up, I wasn't going to get better.
At that level, I'm interested in this. I mean, you said it's a job, and I have no doubt. And I actually hear that as a positive thing, where some people see it as a negative thing. Was there ever an off season? And two, I mean, your college experience is a lot different than the 99.9% repeating. Did you enjoy your college years in retrospect?
Oh, loved them. Loved them. It was a different era, too. There's no NIL. There's none of that stuff. Yeah. It was like kind of the transition from the good old boys to like the – there's no social media. There's actually, Facebook had just started, and it was only for universities. And like, I think Texas was like the 5th or 6th or 10th or something like that. So it was Facebook was still about like chat rooms and stuff, you know. But I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was, you were doing it with like-minded people. You were, you know, suffering together. You were sacrificing for the good of a team. You were part of something that was kind of bigger than yourself and the university. And it was, and doing it in a town like Austin was just, looking back, I mean, we all took it for granted. It was awesome. In the early 2000s, it was awesome. It was like heyday. It was before all the tall buildings, you know? And I think I had a similar experience to everybody else that was doing it because, or at least on my team, we all loved the sport. And we all just loved each other enough that we would go to the well and do whatever we needed to do for the good of the team. And mm-hmm. there was that camaraderie, which is different than being a professional athlete when there's, you know, hey, do whatever you want, man. We don't care. You don't have to show up today, you know. But that the college experience was, it was awesome.
Ever an off season or when the indoor and outdoor season ended, I mean, you're going right back into some sort of training.
Yeah. I mean, in college you run all the way through like mid June and then off season was see you next fall. When you show up for class, we'll start training again. And then professionally the season shifts a little bit. So competed a lot less indoors than I did in college, but the season would run into August and early September. So October 1 was typical start date. Like, hey, let's get things moving again. But the way we program all of October, I mean, there's no weights. There's no real running and jumping on a track. It's all just general prep, like easy GPP stuff where you're getting your body ready to work. Mm-hmm. And by the time mid-November rolls around, now it's like, all right, here we go. You're putting in hours. We're clicking into like the 35, 40 hours a week, a.m., p.m., you know, 4 days a week, and then just one session on the other 2 days. But 6 days a week of training. One day of complete, you know, active recovery, rest, and that kind of thing.
I'm totally off my Olympic years, but 2005, 2006, you graduate in 2006. What's the closest Olympics?
2008. Yep. 08.
And you didn't make the, did you make the Olympics on that?
I did. I ended up making the Olympics. So I had gone to the Olympic trials in 04, and it was like my fourth or fifth decathlon ever, and was just like, oh, shoot, you can be pro at this? This is cool. Like, I was totally naive, like, Bumpkin from Mississippi State. And that's when it kind of clicked for me. Like I need, and my coach leaving and they cut the program. I was like, I want to take this farther. That's the spot for me. I did that, ran into a couple injuries in 07, but signed my first pro contract, then started running for Nike in 07. But didn't compete in a single decathlon that year, just from wrist surgery and tore like the adductors off my pubic bone. And that'll do it.
That happens.
That'll cause you to hang it up. So hung out that year and really struggled until the following March, like March of 2008. I'd done a lot of general prep work. I was strong. I was kind of fit, but I hadn't sprinted and wasn't able to do a lot. And then something in like March, April just kind of clicked. I started seeing a different physio and it just started unlocking, started feeling better. And then made my first Olympic team. And it was just this, like, life was still pretty easy at that point. Like wake up, go to bed, train in the middle a little bit, stress, rest, and you're going to get better. There wasn't any, like, you know, mentally it was hard just because I was hurt and I wasn't able to, like, really be myself. But it just, I was still young enough that the improvements were easy, put it that way.
When you were injured for a year, mentally, how was that? Because what I see the common thread amongst high performers, and you represent the very high percentage of those high performers, when they are down, that is when, like, mentally, like, you see people spiral.
Yeah. I mean, I was young enough. I never really was caught up, like, my identity is this. I'm this guy. I'm the, you know, national champion or record holder. It was just, I learned a lot through it because I would try to do too much too soon, try to come back too quick, and it just kicked the can down the road for another few weeks, and then did it again, kicked the can down the road another few weeks. And so I learned a lot from that experience of just saying, hey, be still, take care of this stuff. Everything's going to be okay. And it really was a lack of confidence and that anxiety of being yes. like, I'm not going to be ready. I'm not going to be ready. I got to put in the work. I'm not going to be ready. Instead of saying, everything will work out. If I do everything smart and do it like I'm supposed to do and do the work, I'll have no regrets. Maybe I make the team. Maybe I don't. Maybe I'm done with the sport or maybe I'm not. But at least I'll be able to live with myself and have no regrets. So that was that, like, that kind of forms throughout the, just the process of being an elite track and field athlete, because there is no, like, it's the top half a percent of half a percent of half. It's just, the difference, it's the Jerry Seinfeld thing, you know, like national hero, no one's ever heard of you. Yeah. And it literally is, we're talking inches of the difference in what, like, going to bed early might mean or something like that. And so I think as a track and field athlete, you're just hypersensitive and very aware and probably read into a lot of stuff a little too much. So that's what makes it kind of hard to rest.
In terms of the, and I've heard this, I mean, help. Steve Prefontaine, I know, was vocal about this, is how much Olympic athletes are supported. I know you had the pro contract with Nike. I mean, you're still living slightly above the poverty line, I'm assuming, or is that comment drastic, a little dramatic in itself?
I think the vast majority of track and field athletes, I think, sit right there.
Yeah.
I think they do it. They get enough to continue training and maybe not have to have a full-time job or a part. Maybe it's a half part-time job, but the decathlon's one of those events that gets to be on TV during the Olympics quite a bit. And the United States has a famed tradition. Like, we're very successful. Dan and Dave, they each made like, it's either $11 or $19 million for that Reebok campaign back in 92. Like, inflation adjusted, that's a crap ton of money. No one's making that anymore. But I was still in what you would call a premier event. You know, it's the 100, the 200, or the 100, the 400, and like the decathlon, and I think that's kind of it. The men's 1500. Those are kind of, I remember seeing a marketing sheet, and it was like tier one, and I was like, oh shoot, I'm in tier one. Cool. And I had no idea. So my first contract, had I made the world championship in 07, I would have made a really good salary, like way above poverty, like really good salary. But I didn't, so I was kind of right there. I remember I could save that whole year, because I invested in myself, got new physios and stuff. I think I saved like $3,000 that year. Like, stored it away and was really proud of myself. And then the next year kind of did the same thing, and it stored it away and ended up making the Olympic team. So a lot of bonuses involved. But by the end, I think I'm on record of saying they paid me way too much. Like, I was...
Other athletes are like, hey, shut up. Shut up.
Yeah. They had a lot between myself and then my teammate, Ashton Eaton, who came out of school, then set the world record, Olympic gold. Between the two of us, we were probably chewing up a lot of budget, like a lot of budget. And so I was just really blessed. I was really fortunate to like have a run of success like I did, have a good agent who had set up a good contract. Super high base salary, like well above most of the, you know, other professional leagues, like league minimums, you know, like it was to me just silly money.
Yeah. The women's soccer team didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
It's a joke. Too soon. No. Too soon. All right. We just got canceled.
Did they win? Awesome. Did they win their case? I haven't been following it.
I think they won the case. That's an interesting. So I understand their perspective, but I also, you know, you run a business now, correct? Mm-hmm. It's dollars and cents.
Yeah.
If I have a salesperson that pulls in $10 million, he is going to be paid $1 million in commissions. If I have somebody that pulls in $5 million, they're going to make $500,000.
Yeah.
And I understand why she's saying what she's saying, but at the end of the day, I mean, men's soccer just brings in more views,
yeah,
more audience.
TV rights are worth more. Oh. There's just, it's kind of, they're not playing the same game in terms of the back end there. And it's hard. Like, I don't think there is a right answer, and there's not a fair answer, and there's not any of that. It's just, it's never going to be copacetic. It's just hard. Yeah.
So the definition of fair has, you know, as you evolve and you mature, like, yeah. Do you have kids yet?
Three children.
No kidding. What ages?
Yeah, 6, 4, 2.
6, 4, 2. You guys are done?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's they technically can't say 100%, but medically improbable that I can produce another child.
Don't get me started there. We're trying right now. I'm an old dog. She's a little bit younger. So, you know, when you teach your kids the concept of fair, I think I'm going to take a different approach,
yeah,
from my parents. Or maybe they did teach this and I just did, you know, I was not a, I was an unruly kid, went in one ear and out the other is you can put all the work in and you still don't win. In the first line, a child usually says, this is unfair.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's hardwired in us as humans. I really think fairness is a big, deep, like, it's why we've done what we've been able to do in terms of civilization, in culture, and all that stuff. Like, have you seen the two monkeys that are given grapes in captivity?
I think I have seen this.
And they each get one, everybody's happy. They each get one, everybody's happy. They each get one, everybody's happy. Then one of them gets his one, and the other one gets two. And the one that gets one just literally goes, sorry, my French, apeshit. Like, goes crazy, and I don't think he doesn't even eat his one. He's so pissed off because it's not fair. And I think it's, there. I don't know what the study was trying to prove, but to me it was like, yeah, I think that's, and then now having kids, it's very much, fairness is a big part of it. But I think fairness gets confused with like equitable or equality or and those kind of terms where what's equitable might not be fair on paper, but it actually is, you know?
So I have a good buddy, actually Will knows him, and his daughter came to him and she was quite upset because she had gotten an A in this class and her friend had gotten a C. And he was trying to reinforce a lesson. He saw an opportunity here. And he asked her a series of questions. Well, did she work as hard as you? No. Did she put the time in? No. Did she do this? No. And she said then her grade is fair for the effort she put in. And she said, well, it didn't soothe the daughter whatsoever. And he said, okay, well, how about this? How about I talk to the teacher? We're going to move your A to a B so that your friend can move up to a B as well. And the daughter said, well, no, I don't want to do that. And he did say something. he's from San Antonio. He said, welcome to the Republican Party. Yeah, but it's an interesting, we're in an interesting time in society right now where the diversity, equity, inclusion is those definitions are not necessarily aligning based off whose perception or experiences they have. And it'll be interesting to see where this settles out. But I mean, I can't tell you in life how many times I put the work in and it just doesn't work out in my way. I mean, I've had textbook failures for companies and I've only been out of the military for 5 years, but textbook failures from which I've learned the most. And
yeah, it's an important part of life. I mean, you learn more from failure than success like every single time. That's not even, there's no argument there. Like you're lucky. Like if you're good, you're kind of lucky. And success is really just staying in the game long enough to get lucky. Be good, work so hard. There was actually a discus thrower at a female discus thrower at the World Championships had no business like
being there.
Fantastic discus thrower. Had to set a personal best on her final throw just to make this team at the US Championships. Like, and it was incredible. She threw a PR, made the team. You're like, great. Hope she gets there and maybe she, you know, gets lucky and makes the final at the World Championships. She won the final. She won. She's a world champion. She set a 4 meter PR on
her. Which is unheard of, probably at that level, because you're going inches.
Absolutely not heard of. But then I had time to reflect on it. We celebrated. It was awesome. Total drama. She unseated the woman who probably should have won, American record holder gal. And I had time to reflect on it. I was like, you know what? It's not, like, that wasn't crazy. That was, she busted her ass for the last 10 years just to give herself the chance to step in the ring and get quote unquote lucky. But she earned that chance to be able to do that because the failure, and staying in the game long enough to get lucky, you know? And I think those are the successful people, the ones who just continue on, that trudge through, that learn from mistakes, that continue to keep going. And that was, shoot, it's all around us now. Like, Instagram's nothing but, like, a bunch of promotional, like, self-help stuff. But, like, Seth Rogen, like, the actor who's like, like, that guy, gave a really kind of powerful little snippet, and he's like, I just didn't quit. Like, I've got plenty of friends that tried this and they would quit after a couple of years. I failed for 2 years and I didn't quit. And the most successful people in my business just never quit. Like, some of them got lucky, but you can see what happens because they quit when it's not happening for them. But the ones that stick around are the ones that don't quit.
I think that's life. That's just, that's the rule of life is just don't quit. Keep on going because other people will stop. There's a difference between quitting and giving up. But
all right, that was a good podcast. That was good.
That's good. Okay, lessons. The first time you walked through 2008 was that Rio?
Beijing.
Mm-hmm. How was that walking through the tunnel for the opening ceremonies? Was it almost like I've made it?
Yeah, it was cool. Like it was that thing I didn't know it. What like I it wasn't a dream of mine to go to the Olympics, but it was a mission and a goal of mine. And it was that box that I got to check, and it was grand and huge. And that was my first time out of the country. So I'm like, whoa, like this is a big deal. Like that Kobe Bryant's right there. Like I got to meet the president. I got to like, it was wild. Like, and it was kind of too big, really. Like it took me over. I was like so hyper-focused on winning a medal that I didn't really enjoy any of it. And I was, like, looking for reasons to, like, oh, well, like, I can't have my normal dinner, so I'm not going to recover as good. Or, like, oh, man, I can't even drink the water out of the fountain, so I'm not drinking as much water as I normally would. And it was just a lot of, like, not looking for negatives, but just not enjoying the fact that I'm at the doggone Olympics, and just got in the middle of the competition. And it was my first time an Olympic schedule. For a decathlon's way different than like a, you know, going and getting a qualifying score or even like the U.S. championships. It's just drawn out. So instead of it being like, all right, you guys just threw the shot, let's go high jump. It's like you're going to do the 100, the long jump and the shot put in the morning session. Then you're going to have 4 or 5 hours before you come back up, maybe 6 sometimes for the high jump and the 400s. Now you've got 2 sessions, a big break in the middle. And then you run the 400 at 9:30. So maybe or 10 on some meets, and you're getting back to the hotel at like midnight, 12:30, trying to get some sleep. But then you have to get up at 5 because you're running the hurdles at 8:30 or 9 in the morning. And it's the same thing, morning session, evening session. So you've got this long, drawn out, exhaustive thing. And I just wasn't ready for or mentally prepared for
any of that. Did you know that going in?
No. I mean, I saw it on paper. And I was like, okay, we'll be all right.
Yeah.
Instead of like, all right, how do you think that's going to feel? How are we going to cope with this in between events? How are we going to do this during the rest periods? How are we going to do this? And no one on my team had done it either. So not that we were blind, but we were just naive. And the moment was so big that it kind of overtook like my body. Like it just, I could feel it in my body. And I was, again, probably looking for a reason for it not to go well at that point. But I was in medal contention. I wasn't having a bad meet. Wasn't having a great meet, but I was right there. I mean, go to my grave saying if I clear a bar in the pole vault, I'm winning a medal. And that was kind of it. It just, I kind of woke up out of this weird dream, and I had missed 3 times in the pole vault, and that was it. That was the end of my Olympic experience.
But left unfulfilled in saying I got one more go.
Yeah. I mean, someone was also paying me to go one more time, but
it's also a good thing. But not that was your motivator, I'm sure.
It made it easier. But no, my coaches sat me down right when we got back to Austin and just said, hey, do you really want to do this? Like, is this something, like, put me to it and challenged me to go leave the sport for a month, you know, go away for a month and really come back, or don't. But you need to figure out yourself why you're here, what you're doing this for, because, like, without saying it, that the whole summer was a waste of time, you know?
They played you. Psychologically, they played you. I bet he left the room. They're like, "Watch, he'll be back in a month."
Oh yeah,
motivated. Where we need his headspace to be.
Exactly.
We'll throw that picture up that I sent you, dude. I'm assuming this is the 2012 again, which was London, right? Did I get that right? The one on the right, Trey Hardy, dude.
That one. That was 1 year after
Beijing.
Yeah, like 1 year after 2009 in Berlin.
How much weight training were you doing?
Like a little bit. Like I you lift a little differently. So that was maybe 2011 in Gotsis, maybe.
In terms of physique, were do you think you were by far ahead of the other guys?
Well, I have really thin skin, so the veins are not from anything other, like you can see my veins right now. Like I've just got really thin, like thin skin. So I did lift, I'd say often, but it wasn't like never lifted for hypertrophy, never lifted for anything other than producing power.
So most of your workouts were on the track?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And there's certain times of the year where maybe like maybe it's 60-40 track to weight room, and that's in the off season. Yes. And we're doing more like building a nice base of work capacity. But I've never, I don't remember ever doing anything over five reps ever. But
was it on the off season where you felt you gained that second or that inch or that centimeter?
Oh, no. Off season was nothing. I wasn't touching a weight, touching the track, nothing. Like, I got as far away from it as I could.
No, and do you think, was that the reset for you, just to, like, completely decompress, get your mind right?
Because it is. It's a full-time job. And I think the difference for me, what gave me longevity was the little stuff. You know, I started to take more seriously everyone calls it a warm-up, but I just called it, like, movement preparation or prehabilitation. I took that so seriously because I knew it was building more robust joints and ligaments for me to be able to do more work and work in, work out. Like that's what was going to make me better. And I was blessed. Like I'm blessed with levers. I'm tall and some people are wired. Some people aren't. I'm tall and wired. And so all I had to do was be patient and get in the weight room a little bit.
Dude. I mean, the New York Jets made you an offer to come try out.
Yeah, they're like, hey, it was after Beijing, and my sports psychologist was ended up being their sports psychologist, and so he's like, hey, we got Trey, you should come out here. I'm like, I don't know why. He's like, they want you to be on the practice squad. Do you think you'd want to do that? And I'm like, man,
compete to be on the team,
right? Yeah, I was like, man, I just kind of went full send on this decathlon thing, and I'm gonna hurt myself out there, like I'm gonna get hurt. Now, that's in the box of list of regrets in my life. Like, I should have at least taken the next couple of steps and seen what it was all about, because I'm in a pool with a bunch of the world's greatest athletes, you know? Like, I'm only around my peers who are fast. Like, 100-meter runners are faster than me. Long jumpers jump farther. Shot putters throw farther. Mm-hmm. I'm not the best at anything, but now on the other side of life in the career that I'm in now, coaching NFL pro bowlers and guys that can do it. I was like, oh yeah, I checked all those boxes. I should have tried that.
It will a testament to your athleticism that they recognize that. But what position were they exactly going to?
Tackling dummy.
Like they had to have
receiver.
Receiver.
Receiver. Yeah.
Tight end.
I was 6'5". I was at my heaviest when I was like pushing like winter weight where we're like not worried about being lean. I was like 216. So I'm like 6'5", 216. And like lean, I'm like at the end of a season, I'm like 208.
So your 100 was pretty damn fast. What was your 100 PR?
10:26. So not slow, but not the fastest. But we trained for the 100, like acceleration development every 14 days. Yeah. And then we did some form of like max velocity stuff every other 14 days. So
yeah, I mean, did you ever throw weight on and do 100 to see how much it affected your
Not really. And you never run like a 100-meter dash in training, but like I could line it up with almost anybody, and at 30 meters, I'm within an arm's length.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's amazing, dude.
Yeah, this fall or this spring, I did a couple of warm-ups, and we get guys ready for the NFL Combine, and they're talking shit, and just like, yeah, man, you're slow, man. Everything you do looks slow. I'm like, all right. Let's see how you do. And our guys are running their first 40s of the year after football season. They ran like 4.7, 4.8. And I was like, I could beat that right now. And they're like, no, you couldn't. And they've seen, I'm not training. I've just been doing like their warm-ups and like just trying to loosen up and feel good. I'm like, all right, I'll do it right now. We got the lasers were all set up. We did it. I went 4.68, like my first time in tennis shoes on turf, like shutting it down because I was about to hurt myself. And I was like, there you go. How's that? And they're like, we're slow.
Hey, coach. Gotcha. Let's get back to working out.
Yeah.
So, silver in the 2012 Olympics. Yep. Eventually, you start to suffer some injuries, and now you said you're training pro athletes, training civilians. What made you take that leap from track to I want this to be my next profession, my next passion?
Well, I didn't. That was another life lesson of mine. I retired, just had a string of like mishaps and injuries and stuff that was kind of beyond my control. Like I'd mentioned earlier, I sleep easy. I did everything right. I worked my butt off. Everything I did was, the intentions were good. I never got hurt or injured for something that was like not right, you know, fluke, freak things, stuff that was just beyond my control. So I sleep easy. I did everything I could have done, so I have no regrets. And when I finished, though, I just wanted to see what else was out there in the world. I didn't really know what I was going to do. It just felt like if I set something up and was trying to angle myself for post-training or post, you know, career, it kind of felt like I was cheating on the sport. You know, like it's Prefontaine, to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift kind of thing. So
yeah, Prefontaine was few screws loose there.
Yeah.
One thing when Prefontaine is I used to go to track camp at Oregon.
Oh, really?
Summers.
No way.
Freaking, we would train hard during the week, and then it was just parties afterwards. Nothing but the cross country and the track girls. It was because it was right around the time that they would have nationals during the summer there. It was a good time.
Yeah, Eugene's a fun town. I'll be back there in a couple weeks for the end of the year Prefontaine Classic.
Yes.
Yeah, close out the track season. And so I'd stored all the money. I'd bought a bunch of real estate. I didn't need a job. I didn't need to do anything. We were starting a family. I wanted to be a very present dad. I didn't want to just jump at the next thing. And I didn't want to make a decision because I had to. And then ended up going and getting my master's. I got my MBA right after at a really competitive program. And now I've got all these new tools. Now I've got like a network. I've got things I could go do. And I just started to try on different hats and none of them felt right. And yeah, I couldn't put my finger on why, but I just didn't want to get back into track. I was like, I've done that. What else is out here? The whole world is out here. There's a bunch of unsexy, great businesses that I could be good at. What do I need to do? And just tried them all on. And it wasn't literally until close to a year ago, about 11 months ago, we're talking 6 years after retirement, that I was riding up in an elevator with the owner of a gym here in town, and we just got to talking. It was a great conversation. He's like, why don't you, hey, come to the gym? I'm like, okay. Blah, blah, blah. We're talking. He's like, hey, you should meet this guy. His name's Mo Wells. He's like, okay, I'll come back in a couple of weeks. I met Mo, and within 2 minutes of talking to Mo, I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. Please, can I come work for you? And ever since then, it really hasn't felt like work, really hasn't done anything except kind of fill my cup. You know, my drive home at the end of the day, I'm excited. Like I'm full. I'm like, it feels like I'm on purpose. And that's what training and stuff was for me. I knew I was supposed to be a decathlete. I was supposed to be here doing what I was doing. And I know what that feels like. It's kind of like I had a plug and the outlet was track, and it was this perfect fit, this very unique puzzle piece that fit right in there. And it just felt complete, whole, and purposeful. And then I just didn't have that for 5.5, 6 years. And it just was frustrating and lonely. And during times, just I felt ashamed for feeling those things. And now I don't feel any of that anymore. Like, I feel like I'm back doing things that fill my cup and that I like where this is going. It feels very familiar to me how I felt starting my career.
For a lot of the SEALs that contact me and they're like, hey, I'm going to go into private equity. I'm like, hey, slow your roll, slow your roll. And what I've come to realize is that you retired early. We usually retire around 40, between 40 and 50. It's more of a process of elimination of trying this. Like, I don't like that. Trying this, too hot, too cold. That's just right. And it takes time for some people.
Yeah. And I think that's the best advice you can give too. It's like, hey, you're not going to find it. You're just not going to find it. But what you can do is figure out what you don't want to do. And then be thankful that you're figuring it out now and not when you're 60 or what, you know, like that was really good advice for me. So yeah, try it on a lot of hats.
And find out what fits. No. I'm having fun right now. It still is a ton of fucking work. We work our asses off. And these guys hate me. I'm just like, I need a video done by tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a party. I'm skipping the party.
Yeah.
Get it done. Thank me for having a job. So you work at the Collective.
Yes.
That was the old, trying to remember, what was it?
Where
it
we are, Collective North, the old CG arena. Yeah,
Camp
the old
Gladiator, Camp Gladiator. Right?
Yep.
Beautiful facility.
Yeah, Allie and Jeff did a great job like building that out. And then now all we did was come in and paint it all black.
Because is there a turf field right next to it? And you guys own that piece of real estate.
That real estate, and that's all getting redone. That'll be all artificial turf with our branding and logos and all that stuff ready for the next like pre-draft combine offseason.
Oh, bro, I got to come check it out. Yeah, I mean, amazing. Anyone can join, right?
Yeah, anybody can join, and it is as good of a high, it's a high-performance facility. It's not a gym. It's a high-performance, like, social club. Like, it's never crowded. It's by design, you know? Like, and we have all the toys, all the tech, all the gadgets, all the coaches. It is fantastic. And you rub it, and you get to, like, rub shoulders with Pro Bowler, NBA All-Star, like, tech CEO. Oh, okay. Like, it really is very unique.
That's awesome. Yeah. I can tell the passion is as you're talking about it. Yep. And I know the whole reason you're here is you've got a row coming up.
Oh, yeah. That's a little paddle.
How many miles?
It's only 21.
Only 21. Have you been preparing for that, though?
I prepared a little bit, more than in years past. So this year, Flatwater Foundation actually took out, we had 13 people go to British Columbia, like North Vancouver Island and the Broughton Archipelago, and we went 75 kilometers in like 72 hours.
With camping on an island.
Camping on your island, whatever you can pack on your board, that's what you had.
Next time, call me. Like Men's Journal will follow you guys and document this whole thing. I had a buddy do that on the Lake Michigan.
Okay.
Between some Ooh, islands.
That can be choppy.
Yeah.
That can be pretty choppy.
A lot of ships have been lost in Lake Michigan.
Yeah. So I did that. That was coolest experience of my life. It was what time of the so year? Fun. This was in June. So it was beautiful. Yeah. It was like the high of 60 every day. The water's 48 degrees. We got lucky with the weather. It like sprinkled on us like one time, but like just one of the most beautiful places in all of the world. Like the most bio-dense place. So everywhere you look, there's something alive that can either eat you or is scared of you kind of thing. So it's like the killer whale, the grizzly bear, and bald eagle capital of North America. So it's just, it was fantastic.
Vancouver, the San Francisco of the North. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm from San Francisco. So, no, that's awesome. I love the very, you know, singular focus of this organization. Can you explain to the listeners?
Yeah. So just the backstory. So Mark Garza founded Flatwater in 2010, and they did it just on a stunt after his experience with his own family. His father was diagnosed with bone cancer, prostate cancer, and had just been going through all the shit that you go through with a cancer diagnosis. And the family was just being like, there was friction, it was splintering, and everybody kind of does that in silence. And Mark had gone to see therapists and just talked to a professional about what's going on and try to get some tools to help cope with what's going on and figure out a way to get through this himself. And after a couple of sessions realizes, oh my God, this is so expensive. Mm-hmm. And then digging a little deeper, you find out insurance didn't cover any of that. And then you find out how many people are dealing with this on a daily basis and the millions of people that are going through this cancer diagnosis. And then you think about, okay, well, it's them plus their family. It's them plus their spouses. It's them plus their kids. It's them plus their parents. It's them plus everybody around them. And so as a stunt, just a marketing stunt, he and a few buddies went out on Lake Austin, and it's a 21-mile lake from dam to dam, from Mansfield Dam to Hula Hut, down near Redbud Island, and they just paddled it. And they had a friend at, I think, the local Fox affiliate, and they recorded a little bit of thing, threw it up on the evening news, and just raising awareness for, you know, mental health and how important it is, you know, coping with cancer, and everybody needs to take care of themselves. And then a couple weeks later, he gets a call, and there's like $13,000 that had been sent in. And he's like, what am I going to do with this? And then a month later, he talked to one of his friends from college who just happened to be the CEO and founder with Lance Armstrong of Livestrong, Doug Ullman. He's like, hey, Doug, I think I want to do this. And so Doug helped him figure out how to set up this event. He did the first ever Damn That Cancer that year, and it started to just, it was this passion and this mission and this thing that he felt so strongly about, created the 501c3, created the event, and then my wife got there a year and a half later, and interned at Livestrong before the whole Lance Oprah thing. And one of the events she helped out on was Damn That Cancer. And DTC has since grown. I think they raised $30,000 the first year. And the goal this year is to raise $1.3 million after a couple of back-to-back years at $1.2 million. And 100% of all the money that's raised by the foundation goes to the mission, and that is covering the costs of mental health therapy and counseling for families associated with the diagnosis.
Say that again. How much? 100%.
100%. Every dollar that's donated. So like right now, I'm raising money to paddle, and every single dollar that hits that account goes to a counselor to reimburse them for talking to a family that's going through the shit, that is just in the middle of existential and very real crises, and keeping families together, helping kids cope with what's going on, keeping spouses focused on what's important, all of that. Everything that Flatwater does is underwritten by corporate sponsors and other means, so that I think one of the big problems that not only my wife and Mark saw from major organizations is that people don't really know where the money's going.
Yes.
It's a tiny drop in a big old bucket. Whereas here, it's Central Texans raising money for Central Texans to give to Central Texans. And they work with tons of great partners like Texas Oncology. They did work with Livestrong. It just is a incredibly, I don't want to say close network, but everybody's way more connected than they think they are. Everyone is probably one degree away from someone that's either literally been in Flatwater Care or donated or raised money for Flatwater. And it's sad that it's so necessary, but it is so important and so impactful, and it is often the first thing that kind of people don't think about.
You are a father. The way I can sort of conceptualize this for me is, like, I would spiral to watch one of my kids suffer from cancer knowing I can't do a thing. And I think it's that helplessness that there's no way to cope with that, especially when you've been in control of almost a majority of the outcomes in your life. That's my biggest fear is when you mess with my family or my kids and I'm powerless to do anything. That chokes me up just thinking about it, man.
Yeah. And I mean, I think thematically, that's a big part of like our own mortality. And then we talk about fairness, how freaking fair it is to have it happen to you, the people you care about, your neighbors, your friends, and it gives you the ultimate perspective. And that's a beautiful thing that Flatwater's given me and my family, is just the perspective on a daily basis of how blessed and fortunate we are and how fortunate we have been, and helps us honestly and celebrate the time that we did get with the loved ones that we have lost. And it is a lesson that we get to pass down to our kids, and it is something that's really important to us. And it truly is, like, from top to bottom, it's grown into something that the founder Mark had no idea it would grow into. And right now it's just full, you know, foot down, full gas. How much money can we raise? How many lives can we impact? What else can we do to spread this message and to get more people involved? And then the next step is to move this into different markets, because it doesn't exist everywhere. And so now that just the logistics and the gymnastics of recreating what the Flatwater culture is in Austin in other parts of the country.
Well, that's noble work. And as I was looking at the team, I went right past your wife until they said something. So I see that. So she's the VP of Impact and Events.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of Men's Journal, the Everyday Warrior, we'd like to donate $1,000 towards the cause. We'll do it right now. I say the Men's Journal, Everyday Warrior, that's me. I'm a vet, so I'll give what I can.
Hey, thank you.
And, you know, that's good work. But more importantly, where can people go to sign up for this event? And we'll drop all, because we're going to do an editorial on you to pair it, flatwaterfoundation.org. But I'm not seeing where to sign up for the event.
The event, this is what makes it kind of unique and special.
Mm-hmm.
The LCRA, the Lower Colorado River Authority,
yes,
will only allow and permit the foundation 200 spots on the water. So while the event has grown immeasurably in monies raised, the number of people on the water has stayed the same. So the first year, you only had to raise $1,000 to paddle.
Mm-hmm.
Then it, a couple years later, clicked up to 1,500, then 2,000, 2,500. Now we're at 3,000, and we think next year it'll have to be more. Because
so you guys are you're full at 200.
Yep.
And each of them had to raise $1,000 to get in.
3,000 this year.
3,000.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. That's amazing.
I'm still like 2,000 short. Like, and to do the big paddle in Vancouver, you had to raise $10,000.
And done. Let me know. Just give me 6 months in advance.
That's it. Yeah. And so to be a paddler on the water, there's an application process because the event is old. Well, the event is now over 10 years old. It's 13 years old now. And we have paddlers that paddled way back in the day. They paddled all of them. They get their spot. You're a old school friend of the foundation. You got your spot. And then that number is growing. And so our ability to take on new paddlers is harder and harder. And it's not like an audition, but there is an application process where we want to hear your story and we want to know why this is important to you and why it means so much to you before we let anybody on the water, because we just can't let everybody that wants to. And so now the waiting list is very, very long.
Is there an after party people can attend, or is there a way they can support you? Absolutely.
That's what I was going to say. The best part is there's no limit on the after party. It's at the LCRA lawn right at the end at the Redbud Center, which didn't know existed before a few years ago. It used to be at Hula Hut. It was a big party, but there was like some commingling and people are trying to have dinner and like, what is going on here? And then now we're at the LCRA lawn. It's all ours. I think we had like 500 or 600 people there last year. Yeah.
And what day?
It is awesome. It is Monday, September 11th, and the party starts at 5:30 p.m. And there's raffles, there's all kinds of games and fun stuff to do, like bring the kids. It is a beautiful sight. The LCRA lawn is awesome.
That is a little further down from where people launch boats?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. It's so as close as you can get to the dam as possible. Like, basically, if you're heading west on Lake Austin, you just, right after you pass Redbud, make a left.
Okay.
And it's right there. And that is, it's just another place and another way for people who can't paddle or didn't paddle to support their friends who are, or just to support the cause. And then really that's like nothing to us. The more the merrier, but the real effort in helping is the volunteers. Like the amount of volunteers it takes to put on a 200 person, 21 mile paddle on Lake Austin, whether it's support boats or setting up a party for 500 people or tearing down the party for 500 people or just logistically moving 200 paddle boards on and off a lake in the span of 30 minutes. Volunteer opportunities are everywhere for this. And that's what I did. So I was competing. So every year DTC was right in the middle of track and field season. It was like the week before the US Championships. And I'm like, I love you, Chelsea, but you don't want me to paddle and then go try to do a decathlon. Yeah. This isn't going to work out.
You're gonna be sore.
So sore. I was volunteer aficionado, helping do whatever I needed to do, emceeing on the party barge. Like, we take out the big old riverboat out there and meet them at the 360 bridge and paddle in with them. And we're blasting music and banging cowbells and supporting them, because it's a long day. Like, it's not a race. It's just a long day.
What's the from when they start to when they finish, what's sort of the average time for the 200?
It depends on the wind and the weather, but we usually try to make it 8 or 9 hours. So if we're starting at pushing off at the low water crossing at Mansfield Dam around 7:15. Mm-hmm. Everyone's on the water at like 6:30. Like, got to get on the water early. And we're pushing out 7:15 and trying to be at the party at 5:30.
Yeah. If you have not trained for that, you're not going to get out of bed the next day. You're going to be in pain.
There's little things you didn't know you had. They'll be sore and blisters and all that stuff. And that's the fun of it, is that most people are really terrified. They're like, oh, I'm not going to be able to do it. That's so far. And then they get out there with 200 like-minded people, and they're sharing stories and developing relationships, and there's community out on the water that people don't even realize they've been 18 miles, 19 miles. Like, oh, we've only got two to go? Okay. Like, it really is a special, special thing out there. You get and just going through that with people just creates this community and bonds and stuff that I think we take for granted a lot of times, of what it means to do something difficult.
Trey, impressive life, impressive what you're doing, impressive passion and selflessness with flat water. We will post the links to everything. We'll try to get we will launch this podcast as quickly as possible. It'll be out of sync, but we'll get it in the rotation. We'll get that editorial, and we'll drop all the links for people to donate for this amazing cause. Congrats, man. Awesome. Thanks for coming in. And for the listeners, whatever platform you listen to this on, Spotify, Apple, please go like, leave comments. constructive comments. That's how we improve, and we appreciate taking the time to do that. All right, guys, we'll see you next time.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.